From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is in Israel today on day three of his first trip abroad as president. He was met by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other officials in Tel Aviv before visiting the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and the Western Wall in Jerusalem. Speaking with reporters earlier today, President Trump tried to brush off one issue of tension. The reports last week that the classified intelligence Trump revealed to Russian officials in the Oval Office was provided by Israel.
Just so you understand, I never mentioned the word or the name Israel. Never mentioned it during that conversation. They were all saying I did. So you had another story wrong. Never mentioned the word Israel.
Neri Zilber is a journalist and adjunct fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He joins us by Skype from Jerusalem. Neri, welcome back.
Pleasure to be back, Jeremy.
So no U.S. president has visited Israel this early in his tenure. What's the atmosphere there now?
The atmosphere, I think, is fairly festive. President Trump received a warm welcome, as have all previous U.S. presidents, including the most recent one, President Obama. Israelis very much appreciate the attention and appreciate the close, what they call bonds between Israel and its closest ally, America.
Tell us about the welcome from the Israeli government, because the Israeli newspaper Haaretz reported earlier that Netanyahu had to order his ministers to attend the airport welcome ceremony for President Trump. What happened there?
Well, I think that's it was more intra-Israeli government politics and posturing. At the end, as people probably noticed, all the government ministers, including deputy ministers, were lined up and received President Trump handshakes, in some cases actually long conversations with the president. So it all worked out, but nothing too out of the ordinary for Israeli politics.
But they wanted to shake his hand, but Prime Minister Netanyahu didn't want that to happen. Why not?
So I think it speaks to a larger point about the visit. They've only had 2 or 3 weeks to prepare, so everything really has been kind of last minute, even down to things that happened today, events and scheduling. We feel that as journalists on the ground. You know, things have come together, but I think the welcome at the airport was supposed to be shorter. So initially, the ministers weren't supposed to be there, just to cut back on time.
Are Israelis generally happy with President Trump, especially compared to President Obama, who many Israelis were not very happy with?
I think that's a fair sentiment. You know, we can argue whether that's a fair sentiment for them to take objectively. But yeah, I think overall Trump is viewed as closer and warmer to Israel and this Israeli government in particular. You know, the Israeli right had a lot of high hopes for Trump when he was elected. That's something to keep an eye on, because a lot of their hopes and dreams coming into this new administration haven't materialized so far.
Is the issue of moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem likely to come up on this trip?
So that's exactly right. That's one of the issues. Obviously, it was a campaign promise by Trump that he has yet to fulfill. The official U.S. administration line is that they still intend to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, but not anytime in the near future.
What about the issue of a peace deal? Trump has said he wants to help negotiate what he calls the ultimate deal, a resolution between Israelis and Palestinians. Is there a chance for that under this president?
I mean, look, he stated that intention. He wants to broker this ultimate deal, as he said. And for the time being, both sides, both the Palestinians and the Israelis, are trying to play ball. You know, he might very well succeed in getting both President Mahmoud Abbas of the Palestinian Authority and Prime Minister Netanyahu into a room. Once they get into that room, as previous U.S. presidents have found, the differences between the two sides are still significant.
Just give us a sense, finally, Neri, of kind of the tension that exists in terms of how a foreign leader who comes to Israel has to act, what they say, where they go. They have to be very careful not to offend this group or that group.
That's absolutely right. You know, every word, every step, every location, as we mentioned, that he goes and visits is put under a microscope, both here and internationally. And that's, I think, par for the course for the Holy Land, a place and a conflict that a lot of people care about. And Trump so far has I think, appreciated that aspect and has acted accordingly. So, you know, the event scheduled and his remarks so far have been fairly reasonable, which I think, given everything going on back home for this president, is a win so far.
That's Neri Zilber, a journalist and adjunct fellow at the Washington Institute, joining us from Jerusalem. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
Well, this Thursday, Montanans will vote for new representative in Congress, a special election being held to fill the seat of Ryan Zinke, now Interior Secretary in the Trump administration. And in a state that went big for President Trump in November, this race between Democrat Rob Quist and Republican Greg Gianforte is tightening, in part because of the Republican health care replacement bill just passed in the House. Gianforte was caught on tape saying he supported it. Quist, a folk singer who wears a white cowboy hat, has called it tax cuts for the rich. Bernie Sanders was in Montana this weekend to stump for Quist.
We need members of Congress who have the guts to stand up to the billionaire class, to fight for real change. And the only candidate running in this election here in Montana prepared to do that is Rob Quist.
Well, Vice President Mike Pence was also in the state this month to try to rally support for the Republican Gianforte. David McCumber is editor of the Montana Standard. David, pundits are comparing the turnout for Mike Pence with the turnout for Bernie Sanders, many more for Sanders than for Pence.
I think that's correct. For one thing, Sanders did four events across the state in 2 days for Quist, and he got good crowds at all of those events.
And Vice President Pence, we understand, had about 800 people, which says what? What's going on there, David? Talk about the health care plan. Republican Gianforte, as we said, got into some hot water in early May after tape was released of him apparently supporting the Republicans' new bill after previously declining to comment on whether he supported the ACHA. Here's what he said on the tape.
All eyes are on Montana. And the reason it has national significance is the votes in the House are going to determine whether we get tax reform done. Sounds like we just passed a health care thing, which I'm thankful for, that we're starting to repeal and replace.
What's been the impact of that?
Well, I think it's definitely hurt Gianforte, primarily because he seems to have said one thing to Montana voters and another thing to donors in D.C. And obviously here, as elsewhere, the ACHA has been pretty unpopular.
Well, Gianforte is a software entrepreneur. He won the nomination to run for this office after losing the 2016 race for governor. Tell us a little bit more about Quist. People have been hearing about this kind of quirky populist who sings and wears a cowboy hat, but we understand the GOP is really going after him, trying to find his flaws.
Well, absolutely. It's curious because both of these candidates, well, neither of them have held public office. They're both outsider candidates. Quist had much more name ID than any of the other Democratic hopefuls for this seat because he was a well-known musician in the state. He was a member of a band called the Mission Mountain Wood Band that achieved some national fame in the 70s. And he's toured for probably 30-plus years around Montana as a musician. So he's pretty well-known. The Gianforte people have pointed out he's had problems with paying his taxes, problems with debt, and this sort of thing. And it's kind of tough to know exactly how that plays. Quist says that his financial woes were a result of a botched medical procedure and the resulting debt from that and inability to work. And so that plays into the pre-existing condition discussion on health care. And so it's been interesting to see how that's going to play and what is going to get traction.
Well, this Republican super PAC that's taking him on has also pointed out that he played at a nudist colony, was busted for marijuana in the 1970s, you know, stiffed a home contractor. You mentioned some of those attacks. Here is one of the ads from a Republican super PAC.
Rob Quist may be entertaining, but on the issues, he's out of tune with Montana. Quist supports a government health care plan even more expensive than Obamacare. More government control, fewer health care choices, higher taxes, and more spending. And with terrorists on the march.
So we hear from both sides there in the race in Montana. David, tell us, is this also considered a referendum on President Trump?
Well, I think it has to be, and I think that's probably one of the reasons the race seems to have tightened in recent weeks with all of the chaos in D.C. Obviously, Trump won Montana by 20 points, but at the same time, Quist's opponent was losing in the governor's race by about 3 points. So it's really not clear how that'll all play out. Special elections often come down to turnout, and I think this one might also. But it does seem that the unsettled nature of the Trump presidency is helping Quist right now.
Well, and the election is Thursday, the day after the budget office, the Congressional Budget Office, is going to score that new Republican health care plan, see how much it's going to cost and how it's going to affect people. So that may have an effect on your race there as well. David McCumber, editor of the Montana Standard, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Robin.
President Trump is expected to unveil a budget proposal tomorrow that includes $800 billion in cuts to Medicaid. And the move comes as a number of states, including Louisiana and Maine, are considering a big change to the program. They want to add a work requirement, which has not been tried in the past. It would mean that certain adults who are able would have to work or do training or community service to get Medicaid benefits. In a minute, we'll speak with Maine's health commissioner. But first, let's look at the research on work requirements with LaDonna Pavetti, vice president for family income support at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
And first, just explain what a work requirement is and when has it been used before?
Work requirements basically mean that people have to either find a job, participate in a program, a work program, or do some kind of activity as a condition of being eligible for benefits. So the best example we have of work requirements are in the Temporary Assistance for Needy Family program. That's a cash assistance program. And they're all able-bodied adults basically are subject to a work requirement. So they're required to work either 20 or 30 hours a week. We also have – we actually have a time limit in SNAP that is sometimes misrepresented as a work requirement. But there, what people are required to do is if they don't have work – they are only able to receive SNAP or food stamp benefits for 3 months out of a 36-month period. There's also another work requirement in SNAP that is more similar to the work requirement in TANF.
So do these work requirements work?
They do not work. In fact, we have evidence from the early years of TANF that basically showed that what happens is you do see some initial bump in employment, but that is very modest and it goes away over time. So if you look over a five-year period, by the end of that five-year period, people who are subject to work requirements are just as likely to work as people who weren't subject to work requirements. The other thing that is important is that we don't have good systems in place to be able to identify people who can and cannot work. And so what we know is the people who have barriers to employment, so it may be that they have mental health issues, it may be that they have physical health issues, it may be that they're caring for a disabled child, often they are subject to work requirements and they're not identified as not being able to meet those requirements and they lose their cash assistance. And what we know from programs is that those people have been the people who have lost benefits the most and are most harmed by them. The other thing we know is over the long term, what we've seen is an increase in deep poverty. So we actually have seen a group of people who have been completely left behind from cash assistance and have no access to cash and have no work.
The other rationale for this, though, is that it reduces costs. It makes the bill lower for taxpayers. The governor of Maine, the Republican governor, Paul LePage, who is calling for adding work requirements to Medicaid, said in March, quote, "If you're an able-bodied American, you need to go to work. It's that simple." So what do you say to that argument?
There are two things to respond to that argument. One is there is no provision to say what if there are not jobs available and you can't find work. And the other is that it actually has the potential to increase costs. And the reason for that is even though there may be fewer people who get Medicaid in the short term, what could happen in the long term and is very likely to happen is that people who need health care aren't going to get it and they won't have the preventative care. So you can just imagine somebody who has diabetes that is not under control. And what happens when diabetes isn't treated is that you end up with far worse consequences down the road.
So certainly there are people like the people that you're talking about who have special circumstances. It's difficult for them to work. They're caring for, as you said, a disabled child, or there aren't the jobs available. aren't there also people who are collecting benefits who just don't want to work?
So the amount of work among people on public benefits is very high. We did a study that showed that 75% of the people who receive SNAP benefits either worked in the year prior or the year after. So that is the majority of people. If you look at a point in time, you get less work. So part of it is just not recognizing how the dynamic nature of work and people moving in and out of the labor market. So certainly there are people who need help getting into the labor market. But the problem is that the conversations about work requirements in Medicaid aren't tied with conversations about how do we increase access to the programs that will help people overcome the barriers that they have. So there's sort of the two things I would say is there is both the skill issue, but there is also the nature of the labor market. And we incorrectly assume that people don't want to work or aren't working when, in fact, if you look over the right period of time, you will see lots of work.
Well, why do you think that people like the governor of Maine are making that assumption? They surely have been told the things that you're telling us right now about the system.
That's a good question, and I'm not sure I have a good answer. I think it is political. I think it is we are in an environment where we are blaming poor people for their situations when, in fact, the fact that they're in those situations has much more to do with the fact that there are lots of jobs that don't provide health care. There are lots of jobs that don't pay enough for people to make it without the assistance that our safety net provides. And there is also a small group of people who are on benefits for a long period of time, but there is an incredible movement in and out. The other thing that people fail to acknowledge is the important role that the safety net actually plays in helping people to get to work. So that we have evidence that for families where kids got SNAP when they were young, so food stamp benefits again, that had huge impacts on their later life of both in work and on their education. And in Medicaid, we have evidence that shows that it actually helps people to go to work. So you're much more able to work if you have a health condition that is under control than if you have a health condition for which you're not receiving care.
That's LaDonna Pavetti, Vice President for Family Income Support at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, now let's turn to one of the states considering seeking federal approval to add a work requirement to its Medicaid program, Maine, where Medicaid serves more than 20% of the state's population, according to state statistics. Mary Mayhew is Maine's Health and Human Services Commissioner. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you, Jeremy. Glad to be back.
And first, just explain, what is the problem you're trying to address? Why is a work requirement being considered for Medicaid?
We are focused on helping individuals out of their dependency on government programs. We want the Medicaid program to function as a core safety net. Back in 1996, when Congress reformed many of the welfare programs, they included a work requirement because we understood then, and we need to understand now, that the best way out of poverty is a job. We want to help support individuals. We talk about the American dream, but then have designed these programs to trap people in a nightmare of poverty.
Well, one of the things that has come up, though, one of the problems with this idea is that it's difficult to determine who exactly is able-bodied, who is able to go out and get a job. Are you concerned about that?
Jeremy, this is really quite well established. The federal food stamp program has had similar requirements in place since 1996 to identify individuals, non-disabled individuals who are capable of work. We know that employment is more than just the income it generates. It is about self-esteem, self-confidence, human dignity. And that's a pathway that we are passionate about reinforcing and supporting.
What if there aren't jobs and somebody wants to find a job but they can't find one?
This is broader than employment, but I will also say that in Maine today, we have thousands of unfilled jobs. Our unemployment rate is at an unprecedented low at 3%. But what this is designed to do, it's not just simply employment. It includes volunteering. It includes being in a vocational training program. Efforts that will help to support someone on that pathway to self-sufficiency, independence.
You talked about the food stamp program and the comparisons there, although what we've learned after Maine changed the food stamp program and added work requirements, it led to a drop in enrollment in Maine, a big drop in enrollment. But food banks say that people are going to them instead.
Well, the data that we have, because we not only monitored that change in enrollment, but we monitored their wages. And for those who left the program, their wages increased by over 114% above the federal poverty level. Too often people are concerned about accepting that job or that promotion for fear of losing their government benefits.
You think that government benefits discourage people from working?
I believe fundamentally that we have designed these programs and they have been a disincentive to work.
What do you say to people who hear what you're saying right now and say this is only going to make it more difficult for poor people to live their lives?
I completely disagree. What we know is that for the last several decades, as these entitlement programs have grown, they have absolutely trapped people in poverty. And we know that we have got to return to supporting individuals on that effective pathway back into the workforce. That is so fundamental to their individual success and to their ability to support their children leading more prosperous and successful futures.
That's Mary Mayhew, who is Health and Human Services Commissioner for Maine. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we welcome your thoughts on work requirements for Medicaid at hereandnow.org.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started. Started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
In Iraq, the offensive to retake Mosul from ISIS is down to the last pockets of resistance, and U.S. commanders say the fight for those neighborhoods will be the most difficult of the entire offensive. Joining us now is Washington Post reporter Thomas Gibbons Neff. He's on Skype from Erbil, but he's been in Mosul. And Thomas, why is this final stage of the offensive going to be the most difficult?
Right. So the final stage is going to be the most difficult because basically you have Western Mosul, which an operation to retake that part of the city began in February after the east was cleared, has been a very difficult fight up until this point. But the last little pocket of Islamic State resistance up against the Tigris River contains the Al-Nuri Mosque, which is where Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi basically proclaimed the caliphate. So there's you have a it's symbolic significance there. And then you also have these neighborhoods, the old city, the neighborhoods that make up the old city in Zangili to the north, which are very dense. So basically the Iraqis have been fighting a very certain way when they clear Mosul using basically the grid-like blocks that kind of, you know, take a street, secure it, and move up to the next one after a lot of U.S. Airstrikes and artillery. And then continue. But these neighborhoods are so dense and the roads are so small that this strategy and these tactics might not be as effective as they have been before.
Now, as we said, you're joining us from Erbil, which is in the Kurdish area of Iraq, but you were in Mosul. What did you see when you were there?
Right. So I was in Mosul yesterday with the Iraqi Counterterror Services. It's a U.S. trained unit, long billed to be kind of the best of the Iraqi ground troops. And, I mean, they were clearing up. They're basically in the last phase of this offensive that began at the beginning of this month. And they were clearing the few final villages before they kind of turn south and push into these neighborhoods I was just talking about. And the Islamic State was still fighting pretty hard. I mean, they were kind of counterattacking in some areas on Friday. They used a sandstorm to launch a small-scale counterattack, which kind of took an Iraqi unit by surprise, also with a counterterror service unit. So, I mean, every day that they go out there, it's definitely a fight.
Now, this fight for Mosul has been going on since October of last year. We're coming up on a year now. if ISIS is finally driven from Mosul, will it have been worth it for the Iraqis and for the Americans?
I mean, I think they would say absolutely. I mean, this is one of the biggest cities in Iraq, and again, a place where the Islamic State declared itself as a de facto state. So I think it has to happen one way or another. And even, you know, there kind of been talks about just kind of leaving this pocket, maybe bypassing or laying siege to it. But I understand that the political pressure to finish this battle is pretty high.
How long do you think it will take?
I've heard Iraqi commanders say a few weeks. I've heard others say it could take, you know, weeks to months. It really depends. It depends if the Islamic State is not going to quit. They're not going to surrender. They're going to fight probably to the last man, from what I'm hearing. So it just depends if they collapse and the defenses collapse quickly, or if they manage to kind of, you know, game the Iraqi tactics and hold out a staunch defense. So it could take a while.
That's Washington Post reporter Thomas Gibbons Neff joining us from Erbil in Iraq. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Researchers say they've discovered the highest density of trash in the world on a tiny uninhabited island in the middle of the Pacific. According to their report in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, an estimated 38 million pieces of trash have washed up on Henderson Island, most of it plastic. Lead author Jennifer Lavers from Australia's University of Tasmania tells The Guardian at first she didn't see how much there was.
We looked down to a depth of 10 centimetres to try and see what plastic, when we look at a beach, is actually being missed because it's buried below the sediment. And what we found is that around 65 to 70% of the plastic present on a beach is not actually visible to the naked eye. You need to go and dig deep for it.
Well, Enrique Sala of Spain is a National Geographic explorer in residence and marine ecologist. He joins us. Enrique, you went to this island in 2012 through your Pristine Seas project, helping establish marine reserves. Did you know how much garbage was there?
Yes, it's difficult not to notice. The whole beach was covered in fishing lines and buoys, flip-flops, plastic bottles. It was atrocious. But there are other places that have not been reported in the scientific literature that are as bad.
Yeah.
There are beaches in Mumbai in India, a beach in Singapore. And all this plastic in the ocean kills hundreds of thousands of seabirds, sea turtles, and marine mammals every year.
Well, and the researcher Jennifer Lavers, who again did this research, they were on a 3-month stay there. They measured 55,000 pieces of trash, and some of it could be traced back to country of origin. What's important about that?
In this particular study in Henderson, most of the identifiable trash came from China, Japan, and Chile. And this clearly shows that trash from all over the world is transported all over the ocean. And we have to think that 80% of the trash in the ocean comes from the land.
You mean comes from people either throwing it on the land and suddenly it ends up in the sea, or from garbage dumps, as opposed to what we also know happens in the ocean. We've reported extensively on this, which is containers fall off from container ships. But you're saying most of it just comes from people using it.
Correct. It could be the plastic bag from the supermarket that the wind takes away, or the microfibers that come out when I wash my polar fleece on my washing machine at home. You know, the ocean is downstream of everything.
Yeah.
So all this plastic that doesn't end up on a landfill ends up in the ocean.
Paint the picture for us of what you saw. Tell us what it's like to walk down this beach.
We were diving around Henderson Island, beautiful place near Pristine, and then you get on your small boat and you go across the reef and land on the beach. And you see this vertical wall, 30 meters of limestone with this tropical forest on top. And it's beautiful. But as soon as you look down, you see orange, green, white, plastic of all sizes and all types. But the worst part is not what you see, but what you cannot see. Because people have heard about these great garbage patches in the middle of the ocean. And there are areas with a great accumulation of large debris. But most of the plastic in the ocean is microscopic. So the ocean, actually, instead of thinking of garbage patches or islands, we should think of the ocean as a giant plastic soup.
Well, we have talked here about this giant garbage patch that is supposed to be traveling like an island.
But in the last year, that's been debunked. You know, this idea that you would see it approaching as this, you know, several football fields of garbage several feet high in the air. That's really not what they look like.
That's correct. There are places with more trash on the surface, but there is no island. Debris that covers a huge area of the ocean. Yes, there are these areas in these gyres, areas where the ocean currents converge and all this trash gets trapped in there. But again, most of the plastic in the ocean is below the surface and it's broken up in very small particles, which the fish end up eating and we end up ingesting ourselves.
You mentioned gyre. Can we picture it like almost the drain of a bathtub or something that makes everything swirl and converge?
Yes. So imagine that you had these counterclockwise currents that go all across the Pacific. And think of Henderson as a wall that these currents hit. So all that trash that is transported by the currents ends up washed on those beaches.
Yeah. Look, it feels, you know, the Henderson Island is now standing as the new metaphor for what you've said is the obituary of the ocean. You say, I'm tired of writing the obituary of the ocean. We see coral dying. We see the effect of both global warming and now garbage. Do you have any confidence that this can be reversed?
It is going to be very, very difficult to clean up the plastic in the ocean, but we can prevent plastic from getting into the ocean. Businesses have to shift to a circular economy where there is no waste, where every material is going to be reused into something else. And then the consumer also has a responsibility. For example, I don't use single-use plastic bags. I have my strong canvas bags that I have been using for years. I don't use plastic straws. So if the consumers don't use single-use plastics, we're going to have a big impact in the way things are right now.
That's Enrique Sala, National Geographic Explorer in Residence and marine ecologist, talking about the unbelievable amount of trash that was discovered on a remote island, Henderson Island, in the Pacific. Enrique, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Richard Spencer, the white supremacist who led fellow supremacists in a Nazi salute to the then new President Trump, has had his membership terminated at Town Sport and Health Gym in Alexandria, Virginia, after he was confronted by Georgetown University Associate Professor C. Christine Fair. No wallflower. She took on Pakistan's military in her book Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. She says their intelligence service now threatens to gang rape her. Now she's getting vicious attacks from the far right. And by the way, the language here is probably going to be pretty offensive. But Professor, what did you say initially to Richard Spencer in the gym?
Well, I first went up to him and I said, are you Richard Spencer? He first lied and said he wasn't. And I said, so not only are you a Nazi, you're a pusillanimous Nazi. As a woman, I am sick and tired of your nonsense. This country does not belong to Christian white males. You're a disgrace to this country. You're not welcome in this gym. You're not welcome in this community.
Well, we understand that he actually asked his trainer for some help, kind of getting you away from him.
Well, it wasn't his trainer. He was actually seeking assistance from one of the young African-American female trainers. So I thought that was absolutely precious, that this ubermensch white supremacist misogynist needs help from an African-American woman because he's being confronted for being a Nazi by another woman.
Okay, look, he was, though, just quietly working out, minding his own business. And we understand that gym managers came up to you because you're the one who started the confrontation. What'd you say to them?
You, by allowing this man to be here, not because he is a private Nazi, but because he is a public Nazi, are creating a hostile environment for your employees, and they can file a class action suit against you, and they can own this gym. And he had also, another important point to note, that a few weeks previously, he had exercised his right as the gym manager to censor my own speech. I have a cap that says, Puck Trump, but it does look as if that P is an F. It's very subtle. And he asked me to remove it. So I reminded him that you used your GM position to censor my speech. So you don't have a problem with a Nazi, but you had a problem with my hat?
Well, initially you thought you were kicked out and you and your husband were prepared to quit. But then you got a call from the club saying that they'd actually sent the letter to Spencer saying he was terminated. Look, what do you say to people who say, we have freedom of speech, and in fact, in a gym, he is a private individual and not bothering you at all?
Well, I think that logic is flawed. We do have freedom of speech, and just as he is free to be a Nazi, I also have a right to tell him that he is a hateful human being, and just because I'm not at one of his rallies does not mean that this man is not accountable for the things that he says and the things that he does. In fact, I'm going to go further. if good people do nothing, things are going to get worse.
Well, you've also been involved before with Trump supporters who, he got into squabbles with. It ended up on Fox News. You have been vilified already on social media by the right wing, and you've received missives, we know already, from people who think that you are Jewish and have commented on other things as well.
If you can imagine, Fat Kikas, get into your oven. An email I got today was, Fat Kikas, I hope you're gang raped by a spick or an N-word. So I think if this had been my first rodeo, this would be, in fact, very traumatizing.
That's C. Christine Fair, associate professor at Georgetown. Professor Fair, thank you so much for speaking with us.
And thank you so much for having me and covering this story.
There's still plenty of snow on the mountains in Juneau, Alaska, even though it is almost summer. But as the weather warms and the snow melts, there's a big chance of avalanches, posing major risk to transmission lines, which bring electricity to the city from a hydroelectric dam dozens of miles away. That's why Alaska Electric Light and Power Company uses helicopters to trigger an avalanche before a more destructive one knocks out the power. Jacob Resnick from member station KTOO went along for the ride to find out how it works.
Much of Alaska Electric Light and Power Company's power grid is miles from any road. Flying at about 4,000 feet in a chartered helicopter, AELP's avalanche forecaster Mike Janes gives me the lay of the land. He points to high-tension power lines that traverse an area southeast of Juneau.
And this is all power coming from Nedisham, where we're headed, and then the Lake Dorothy project is over there at like 10 o'clock.
Extreme swings in temperature, blaming on climate change, have made the snowpack in the mountains less stable. That's kept avalanche control crews busy.
In the time that I've been doing this, we've had record snow years at Alpine and record low snow years in Alpine, all within a few years here. If anything, like, that's making it more extreme, gives us the possibility for more layering to develop.
Warmer conditions that bring rain or wet snow can form a weak layer on top of snowpack. When the weight from a top layer exceeds the strength of an underlayer, it fails, triggering an avalanche. It's these types of conditions that threaten the transmission lines. Juneau was cut off from hydropower for 45 days in April 2008 after a slide knocked out lines. AELP had to burn diesel to keep the lights on. It was as environmentally unfriendly as it was expensive for the utility and ratepayers. After that experience, the power company invested millions in its avalanche control program. With the help of state grants, the utility erected barriers to protect its most vulnerable transmission towers. AELP also employs a team of seasonal technicians to attack trouble spots. The bird's eye view has its limitations. Our helicopter touches down near the summit of 3,300-foot Arthur Peak to drop off me and avalanche technician Kanan Bosler. He's running a simple test on the snowpack on this side of the mountain.
Basically, we cut out a block in the snow and try to see how the energy that we are putting on the snowpack by tapping on it with our shovel, how that transfers through the block. 14, ECT 14, propagation quality 1, sudden planar. Sudden collapse. Wow. That's pretty exciting.
Bosler calls in the results, and the helicopter returns. Hovering at about 150 feet, the chopper dangles a device called a daisy bell. It's about the size of a phone booth and weighs about 1,000 pounds. The daisy bell contains two tanks, oxygen and hydrogen. The helicopter crew opens a valve, blending the gases. An electric spark is remotely triggered, igniting the mix.
Kind of see that one go, a little flash. But yeah, it creates quite a nice explosion, pretty good punch to the snowpack.
Gone are the days of dropping high explosives by helicopter. This is a cheaper and safer solution. Hovering at just 100 feet, Mike Janes and the pilot position the daisy bell just a few feet over snowpack that's layered into a natural overhang from the peak.
7 meters, 8, 7, 6, 5, filling, 4, 3, 2,
There hasn't been much movement. Then the crew realize they triggered something big.
You can't see it, but we got probably 100 foot wide. Looks like it's down on that layer. I don't know which shot it happened on, but it pulled out like 20 feet below one of the shots we already made.
After 45 minutes of firing, the crew's work is done, for now. Bosler says modern avalanche control is often more methodic than dramatic.
Any day that we can come out and trigger some snow off the slope that isn't just stacking up there and waiting for a bigger slide to come, then we feel pretty good about that.
Avalanche crews will work through spring to keep nearly 60 miles of overhead transmission lines protected from slides. That should keep hydropower flowing to Juneau's households and businesses all year round. For Here and Now, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Well, today in Pittsburgh, the search for 12 jurors who will consider the sexual assault charges against Bill Cosby got underway. We'll have the details later today on All Things Considered. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.